I'm Nadia Taylor, Training and Exercise Manager for the Readiness Support Center. And this is Semper Gumby, a podcast about emergency management in the Corps of Engineers. We'll cover topics about disaster response and recovery, FEMA mission assignments, and Corps-specific response authorities under which we operate for things like flood fighting and coastal emergencies. Today we're going to be talking about the Deployable Tactical Operations System, or DTOS, and we have with us Terrell Bosarge. So Terrell, what do you do for the Corps?
I am currently the what's called the National Team Leader for the DTOS system. So I have four positions in my office, and we manage a fleet of emergency response vehicles across the United States that deploy in support of man-made or natural disasters.
So I know DTOS is kind of the combination of a fleet of vehicles and also a team of people. So let's start with maybe just the mission of DTOS. What is DTOS here to do and to provide?
So we provide a rapid ramp up of deployable equipment and teams that are able to provide basically your office set up in a remote location that's totally self-sustained as far as power and communications and so forth. And we do this across the United States with various teams from around the Corps.
Terrell, tell me a little bit about the different types of vehicles that we have in our DTOS fleet.
Okay, so we have what we refer to as the big truck. That's the ECCV, or Emergency Command and Control Vehicle. That's a 47-foot box truck. It's a straight truck, so there's no bend in the middle. And it basically provides workspace for 11 to 15 users, as well as all the communications and the creature comforts, refrigerator, microwave, and so forth. So it's made to deploy in a remote location where you really have to be self-sustaining. The MCV, which is a more compact version in terms of communication than the ECCV, is a mobile command vehicle, and it's really made to provide communications into an existing facility where you have adequate desk space and creature comforts and so forth inside of a hotel or building or whatever. So we can bring communications inside from that vehicle either via wired or wireless communications and provide support in that way. We also have a third system that's not really a vehicle. It's a containerized system. We call it a CTOC. So it's a containerized tactical operations center. Provides all of the communications that the vehicles provide, but in a completely containerized system that can be shipped either privately or commercial air to really anywhere, any location in the world.
Now, we've talked about the different type of vehicles, but tell me exactly what kind of equipment is available on these vehicles.
So the primary mission, of course, is communications. We have varying levels of communications within the unit, all of it designed to be operational within the self-sustaining system. Primarily, we have for data. Recently, we've upgraded to a cellular data system. So this is much like the MiFis and your hotspots on your cell phones, where we can provide very high speed bandwidth for users over a cellular data network. Of course, the problem with that is in a Katrina situation or even a Sandy, the reliability of that network is usually very low. The backup to that as far as data communications is satellite communications, and that's really been the bread and butter, if you will, of communications for DTOS since the first generation. It's only in the last year or so that we've been able to really turn that into a backup form of communications for data. Beyond that, we have, you know, a lot of things that most people are familiar with. We have onboard cellular, which is a cell phone that's rack mounted, but it just works just like your cell phone, and we pay for minutes and so forth. And then we have external to the VSAT satellite system, we have an Iridium satellite phone, which is just a standalone voice-only satellite phone that works very similar. Beyond the satellite communications and the cellular, we have several types of radio. So we have HF, VHF, and UHF radio. What gets used the most there is probably the VHF. VHF is a system that can be made available in a portable radio where we can really assign those out to folks and then they can go out in the field. We have a repeater on board for VHF, as well as a 42-foot mast. And the combination of that equipment provides about a 10-mile radius on those handheld radios. So you can see the value in that in a Katrina where you have no cellular service and yet you still need a close-range communication. The HF system, though it's very rarely used, is a system for long-haul communications. If we were to get in a situation where, for some reason, we had no satellite backup comms for voice, then we would rely really on that as a tertiary form of communications for voice only.
Okay, now we have a mix of those vehicles and containerized systems here in Mobile, is that right?
That's correct.
So what's actually here in Mobile?
So in Mobile right now, we have ECCVs 1 through 5, and then we have MCV 2, and then we have a CTOC.
But that's not the only place that we have DTOS. We have assets all across the country. Can you tell me some other places that we have equipment?
The other locations where we have equipment in varying degrees is Fort Belvoir, Virginia. That's the 249th Prime Power Battalion. And then York, Pennsylvania is part of the Baltimore District. So we have a unit there. We have a unit in Nashville. We have a unit in St. Louis. And then we have a unit in Fort Worth, Texas. And then on the West Coast, we have units in Portland, Oregon, Sacramento, California, and Los Angeles, California. In addition to that, the only other CTOC that we have is positioned in Honolulu, Hawaii.
So we have assets all across the country, like you just described. So what is the point of having all of these vehicles in different locations spread out on the West Coast, East Coast, and then in the Midwest as well?
So early on with the first generation of equipment, the consideration was taken to be able to make the geographic disbursement of the equipment such that we were in close proximity to the high risk or vulnerable areas where we might have some sort of natural disaster. However, that's not the complete reasoning behind the locations. There also has to be a district, a custodial district, that has both the manpower and facilities and so forth to be able to provide the support to that vehicle in terms of a team and a facility, so that we can house the unit and so forth. So that's also a huge consideration when it comes to where the equipment is dispersed.
Okay, now how do these vehicles get deployed? Because I think a lot of people think that it's up to us here at the Readiness Support Center, and I know that's not true. So can you walk me through that process?
I can. So the way this works is a request will usually come up from a district to a division and then ultimately to headquarters or the UOC. The UOC will evaluate those requests, and based on some input back from my team and my staff at DTOS, we'll fulfill those requests as necessary. We really don't move anything anywhere unless we get that confirmation from the UOC. So the UOC is really the control point, if you will, the command part of this whole system, and they really call the shots as far as when equipment deploys and where it deploys and what missions we support and so forth.
Okay, and just to be clear, the UOC is the USACE Operations Center in Washington, D.C.
That is correct.
You also mentioned that a crucial part of DTOS is the team that is behind the equipment as well. And I know all of these teammates, they are volunteers. So can you tell me a little bit about the training, how people get up to speed on the DTOS equipment and what they have to do to keep those things maintained?
The very first thing that I will tell folks that come out and visit, we get a lot of visiting commanders from various districts and divisions and so forth, and I always want to emphasize to those folks that the most important part of what we do and really the most important element of the system is the people. We have a lot invested in the teams that we have throughout the various custodial districts and in the way of training, some in the way of experience and so forth and so on. So, you know, the training can happen in a variety of ways. Recently, in 2010, we did what was called a recapitalization. So we completely upgraded from our first generation of equipment to a new generation of equipment. It was completely different. So at that time, we factored in for that upgrade some training costs. So we went to every custodial site as their new equipment was delivered and did a top-to-bottom level two, what we call level two training, with all of the current team members at those custodial sites. So that really got us kind of to a standard, if you will. Beyond that, obviously, there's some turnover within the teams at these places. People retire and different things happen. So there's always a need to train up new folks. You know, there's a couple of ways that that happens. We try to take advantage of opportunities we have where we're going to have exercises, where we already have funds obligated and committed to go and do an exercise, for instance, with the power team. So a lot of times we'll purposefully bring those new people in from the various custodial districts to that exercise and host a training event at those exercises. So that not only saves us some time and money in terms of cost, because we're already going to be there anyway, but it also gives those brand new team members some exposure to a real event that you'll have, or a simulation, I guess, at an exercise. On more of a rare occasion, I guess, because we're dealing with, you know, a person here or a person there, we will bring people into the Mobile District, which is where our office is located, and then host more of a large-scale training event for people from all over, from lots of different custodial districts, and just bring them in. Because the good thing about what we do and the equipment is it's all the same across the board. There's really not a lot of variance in the types of equipment out there. So if we train someone on a vehicle in Mobile, for instance, then they're going to be trained up even if they were from Sacramento or St. Louis or some other district. So that's really how we cover training, a lot of different ways that we do it. We try to do what makes sense and what really costs the least amount in terms of money and really my team's commitment on in terms of time and travel and so forth to maintain a good level of team commitment throughout the custodial districts.
Okay, now you mentioned the exercise, and I know you guys recently deployed to the Power Exercise in Atlanta, Georgia. But tell me about some actual real-life event deployments that you've had recently.
As most of the emergency community will know, in the last few years, we really haven't had any large-scale Katrina or Sandy-type events where we had huge deployments of large teams of people and equipment. What we have had in the last few years have been some flood events. In fact, we have a unit deployed right now to a flood event in Arizona. You know, those are really very different from a Sandy or a Katrina or even a 9/11 in so much as it's just a lot easier to care and feed for one deployed unit as opposed to the 11 that we had in Sandy, for instance. So it's very different. So I really can't speak recently to any kind of a large-scale deployment like that outside of maybe an exercise. But, you know, the last large deployment that we had where we had 11 units deployed was Hurricane Sandy up the East Coast. And that was a big challenge for us. A lot of man hours went into that, both out in the field and at my office with my team.
So why was it so challenging beyond the manned hours?
We're a five-person office, so this is a management team that manages 20 unique pieces of equipment across the Corps in all the custodial districts. So for Sandy, for instance, we had those five employees managing 11 different pieces of equipment that were supporting sometimes up to 20 users at a time. So just keeping up with diesel fuel coming in and making sure we had power all the way down to office supplies and printer cartridges and everything that it takes to sustain an operation like that for 30 or 60 or 90 days is a big challenge for five employees when you've got that many units deployed and supporting that many different teams and teams of people out there.
And real quickly, you mentioned 9/11. Tell me what we did in 9/11.
So in 9/11, that was a very unique mission for the Corps, especially in terms of DTOS. You know, most of the time, DTOS deploys in support of one of our core ESF3 missions, be it a power mission or a debris mission or something like that. So most of the time for the Corps, it's our people, our PRTs, that occupy and utilize our equipment and our teams. 9/11 was very different in that we were really providing support to the emergency personnel of New York, the firefighters and the policemen and the Border Patrol and all the different folks that were rarely in that fight, if you will. So it was unique because it was something that DTOS hadn't done before as far as providing that kind of support to people that weren't us, if you know what I mean. But it was also very rewarding because we were providing support to people who were doing a very demanding job at the time. And just to be able to bring a phone call to home or maybe an email across or something like that for those guys that were out there digging through the rubble was very rewarding for the DTOS.
All right. Well, thanks, Terrell. We appreciate you being here, and hopefully everyone has learned a little bit more about DTOS.
Thank you.
That's all we have for today's episode. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you've learned something. Please subscribe to our feed and check back for future episodes. I'm Nadia Taylor, and this is Semper Gumby.